Hello, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Matt Taibbi, and we're broadcasting from Quarantine City.
Yep.
Third world. This is our new reality, virtual entertainment, virtual everything. How are you adjusting to it, Katie?
I mean, I just got up to my alternate location last night. So it's not in the city, which is nice. It's outside the city. But we'll see how crazy I go. Which we had the woke button. That's ableist, but
we're going to have a new virtual woke button, and you're going to be able to see us hitting it with a cursor, I think, is the idea. We have not yet developed that technology, but we're adjusting. It's all about the adjustments in this post-COVID reality. So we're going to do everything we can to make life more amenable to you, the consumer. So this is crazy. Right. This is I have a lot of mixed feelings about this already. I think.
What's the mix?
Let's just say I understand the need for all this caution.
Myself,
but I think that there's the overboard factor is getting a little bit.
You're saying it's mixed. Your response is, I thought you meant mixed on COVID. I was like, I don't really see the upside to it.
It's not that. I'm just a little concerned about the response and what the long-term implications are. But for now, hey, look, this is I'm going to enjoy this. I'm going to stay home. I'm going to get fat and listen to Devo records all day long, and that's pretty much all I'm going to do. What's your plan?
Well, maybe now that you've mentioned that, I should do a workout. I should really focus on working out because yeah, and I'll take advantage of your getting fat to look thinner. By contrast,
we'll have like a synergy, or I don't know what that would be.
What would it be?
I'm not sure.
Some kind of zero sum game thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, there's also lots of stuff to talk about in politics, so I guess we should get to that too. Yeah. Right. Four food groups.
Yeah.
So for Democrats suck, and I'm going to contradict myself here because I think the biggest thing, the most egregious thing, was the DNC's decision to hold the primaries and Tom Perez. And then we have some video of Perez talking on MSNBC with Chris Hayes, which was pretty amazing.
It is your view that this can be safely conducted tomorrow. Who have you been consulting to come to that view?
Well, again, we didn't intervene in that case.
No, I know. This is a state matter, but I'm asking your position as Tom Perez, the head of DNC. Sure. My understanding is you're saying you agree with the states that are going forward.
Yes, we respect what they're doing, and we always encourage everyone. And I was in contact today with people in a number of these states, including but not limited to Arizona, and again asking them if they believe they have the systems in place that enable them to put the elections on tomorrow, and they do.
We respect what they're doing. They just decided willy nilly that they wanted to press forward with the primaries. Obviously, Ohio took a different tack. Their governor stepped in and canceled the primary, so we didn't have an Ohio primary. But we have some amazing footage from the other scenes. We got let's take a look at Chicago, some of the scene from Chicago. So yeah, we have a long line of people too, like 200 people long, and so all these people are going to be they're basically standing 6 feet apart from each other, but for like forever. There's another photo, the next one, Dan, if you could see it, it's a scene of people in a polling station. Yeah, so here's people in a poorly ventilated underground situation. They're all crammed into each other. There's a long line. People have to wait to vote. And here's some people in Chicago talking about what that was like.
There are senior citizens sitting in there. They've been in there 2 to 3 hours waiting. There are too many people smashed together in there. It's too close in there. They're talking about all of this. What's wrong? It's taking too long. And I mean, I've been standing out here an hour myself. Too many people in there. None of the senior citizens are being waited on. They're just sitting there and waiting. And a lot of people are leaving. They're not voting because they haven't waited so long. So they're leaving.
It's obvious. I mean, everybody in the world basically has already concluded, like, the NBA, the NHL, basically every sports league in the world is canceled. There's gatherings of any size have basically been banned all across the country. And despite what I just said, we don't know a whole lot about what's going on, but everybody's sort of taking the position that, for the time being, let's err on the side of caution. Let's avoid large gatherings, especially in poorly ventilated areas where, you know, because this is a disease that's sort of translated, you know, it's an aerosolizing, right, virus or whatever it is. So the fact that the DNC pressed forward with this, 100%, if the primary was going in a different direction, if Biden were losing and they wanted to halt the momentum of whoever was winning, it seems abundantly clear to me that they would be calling for primaries to be banned in every state. And it's just the cynicism of this is extraordinary, because in all other areas, everybody's backing these incredibly draconian measures, but just by an extraordinary coincidence, they want to go forward with this. Because why? Because then they got the wipeout result in Florida, they got the wipeout result in Illinois and Arizona, and, you know, which I guess from their point of view is a good thing.
Yeah. And they're now, of course, implementing mail-in. They're now allowing for mail-in ballots, coincidentally, after that. I don't know. I mean, okay, I feel really naive, but I really felt like this is something Trump would do or some really ghoulish Republicans. But the Dems are really like, and you know, Matt, obviously, I'm very critical of the Dems, but this is, for me, like a different level of ghoulishness that I didn't totally think was possible.
For the DNC to sit down and have a planned
right
position on this, having thought it through, having come out like this is what our posture is going to be on, right, on this, is kind of extraordinary, I think, given the circumstance.
And weren't they going to punish states that did that?
Oh yes, they were going to reduce the influence of delegates from those states. So
unbelievable,
right? Yeah, which is totally craven. I mean, we're in like a new reality where, you know, the things that we used to consider normal or ethical or whatever are no longer really part of the equation. Because, and I think it's important to understand that a lot of this is because for the first time, something is really at stake in American politics, right? Like, in the past, if you had John Kerry winning instead of Bob Graham or whatever it was, like, they weren't particularly worried about the
right
results. But, there's a lot at stake when the three candidates that are left are, you know, or Tulsi's in it too, but, you know, Sanders and Trump and Biden, all of them are kind of, you know, there are major ramifications for any one of those folks winning. So,
right.
Yeah. So they're pulling out all the stops. It's amazing. Other, just really quickly on Democrats sucking this week, the Democrats voting to re-extend the Patriot Act or provisions of the Patriot Act with overwhelming numbers. Of course, it got absolutely no press in the middle of this, but just to remind everybody, especially with Biden on the ticket, that this is the party that backed all those crazy draconian post 9/11 surveillance measures, and they're still doing it. So that's great. What do we have for Republican suck?
Listeners and viewers may remember that we saw Sean Spicer do a very good Latin dance, and we couldn't decide. Matt, you brought in this clip, and you couldn't decide if this was Republican suck or Republicans are awesome.
Right.
And we have a similar dilemma, similar potential debate with this clip that I'm presenting. So can we go to the videotape?
Right now, here to perform Unmasked once and for all, I can't wait for this, the artist formerly known as the Bear. Y'all make some noise for Governor Sarah Palin. Can I be your hype man?
She really let it fly with that. I mean, yeah, I admire it. I don't know. I'm not a fan of Sarah Palin's, but she really, that takes a lot of guts. Not only to wear that, but she really belted that out.
I know. And that line, she's like, and I'm thinking about sticking.
Red Beans and Rice didn't miss her.
It's a great song. It's actually a great song. I think it's a feminist song. It was ahead of the curve in terms of body positivity.
Yeah, okay. I mean, right.
It's totally totally objectifying, but it's objectifying in a new direction.
Okay.
You know all what right. I mean?
No, but that's okay. I'll accept your pronouncement on that. That's good. Yeah.
It's woke. I think it's woke.
Is it woke? All right.
Proto-woke, yeah.
What a weird world we're living in, where suddenly, like, you know, that's your family values party right there. Belting out Baby Got Back and Up Is Down, Night Is Day.
But you know what I'm upset about? She didn't say one of the best lines in that song, which is, "My anaconda don't want none unless you got buns, hun."
She didn't do it?
No, I don't think I think she didn't do that, which is upsetting.
Yeah, she wouldn't say the word horny either.
I know, but yeah. She would say stick it. She may, honestly, maybe she doesn't even understand what that's a reference to.
I think she understands all the references.
Right, but she just wouldn't say horny?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That's
really into literary devices.
What's the verdict on this? I mean, I think instead of two thumbs way up, what's the Republican two elephant
guns
way up?
Oh, or guns up? Yeah, especially with her
two way up.
What does she kill? Wolves? Two wolf heads way up.
Wolf heads way up.
Yeah, like literally, right. You know, instead of being mounted like normal, the wolf right. Heads on the wall, they're like facing up.
Right. That was, so I don't know. I don't think that's really a Republican suck. I think you owe us another one next week.
I know.
I could watch that over and over and over again. Actually, no, probably not. There's probably a limit to how many times I could watch that. Yeah. But we haven't hit it yet.
Oh, yeah. One thing I wanted to add about with the Democrats. I wish that Tom Perez had gone to the polling stations while people were voting to observe and monitor and be in that close, enclosed space with a bunch of people. I do. Kind of, but then he would be potentially spreading it. But if somehow he could have gone to those polling centers and then we could then we could isolate him and quarantine him.
They would have figured out a way to fake it somehow, yeah. Like Barack Obama drinking the Flint water.
Exactly, exactly. I was just
they would have put yeah. a cardboard waving Tom Perez, you know, and taking photos of it, you know.
Which I don't think is very different from the real life Tom Perez.
Right.
He's about as uncharismatic and cardboard-like as you can get.
Okay, isn't that weird? I mean, everything is coronavirus related. So we've got coronavirus merch is now becoming a thing. So you got all kinds of stuff too that's becoming popular to buy. Lots of interesting new products, and it's pretty odd. So we have you can buy on Amazon now, you can buy a baby spittle hat.
Oh my god, what?
So it's like a salad bar thing that goes over your child's face, your child who's already wearing a surgical mask. So that's one product.
So it's an anti-spitting protective hat, kids dustproof cover, boys girls hat, fisherman cap. So it's a hat that comes with the mask.
Yes,
I'm looking at it right now.
It comes in different colors with little messages on it.
People who can't see, it has like a plastic shell
right
under the cap, so it's a fisherman's hat, fisher hat, whatever, and then there's a round plastic thing underneath it that blocks you off. Yeah,
I mean, this is only the beginning. There's going to be they're going to be selling plastic bubbles for people to walk in pretty soon. I think that's probably a week away from that, but this is where it starts. We also have there's a whole bunch of things you can buy now that are stickers or signs that let people know that you are infected. So let's look at the motorcycle trailer. So there's a warning coronavirus stickers that you stick on your car or for your bumper car or on your laptop, your cell phone, your bike. That's already happening. Yeah, if you're off-road coronavirusing. This is the sticker that you put on. Also very, very popular, becoming more popular, is the thermometer gun. Dan, if you could take a look. So this is so you can kind of go up near somebody and you might have even seen people doing this already. They sort of aim this at somebody and they want to, if you want to see what temperature they are, and it'll make a little red, infrared dot on the person near you. Apparently they're not terribly reliable. Or accurate, but people are, they want to know if the person near them is having a fever. So that's going on. So there's all kinds of stuff that's being sold. I think it's going to get, this is something we want to revisit from time to time because it's going to get stranger.
Like every week we can feature a new product.
Yep.
It was actually a gun that could take your temperature. Like I thought it was a gun when I heard
about it. Oh, you mean like it would shoot you and take your
temperature? Yeah. Like that's you would take their temperature and then depending on that, you'd shoot them.
that actually would be handy. That's like an anti-zombie type of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is the person infected? And right. Then yes, we should shoot them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what do we have for Isn't That Terrible?
We have news that this disease, corona, this virus may have come from bats who, the bad thing about bats, and now I'm kind of on a campaign to maybe get rid of them, like I used to be about cats, but I've come around on cats. But a study published in 2015 in the Nature Journal had warned that severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, like viruses circulating in Chinese bat populations may pose a serious future threat. And the thing that's scary about bats is that they can have these things and not die. I guess they're very like resilient. So they walk around, they fly around with these diseases and they don't drop dead like they should. And then people are exposed to them.
Yeah, I think the scary part about the thing, this story, and you'll see already that some news services are starting to hammer this theme a little bit, is this idea that there's a, you know, you'll see this word reservoir floating around, that there is a reservoir of not yet released acute respiratory viruses that is coming, so that this is only the first wave of many future COVID type diseases. Which means that we could be theoretically in a state of permanent lockdown. So that's, we started this feature as a joke because the news always wants to give you a little bit of terrifying, potentially horrifying news somewhere in the broadcast, because scared news consumers are good news consumers. They'll come back and watch tomorrow. But this is basically the whole broadcast is going to be like this from now on, at least for a while, which is a little crazy. I guess what I'm saying is the parodic nature of this feature is starting to lose its teeth a little bit, because yeah, this isn't even funny anymore.
Terrible. Yeah, and I have to update my take. I take that back. So actually, according to someone quoted in this article, a wildlife biologist and Indian bat conservation unit, there's a myth. He explained that in India, myths cause ill-informed people to kill bats, which adds to the stress. Quote, it is true that bats are reservoirs for numerous viruses due to their extraordinary immune system and physiology, but the chances of contracting a disease in natural conditions are extremely low. Of course, unless one heckles bats needlessly. Okay, so guys, don't bat heckle.
Okay, no bat heckling.
No bat heckling, no matter how bad their set is, no matter how bad their stand-up is, don't heckle them.
You know what, we've been looking for a slogan for Useful Idiots.
Yeah.
Maybe that could go on our merch. Useful Idiots, no bat heckling.
Yeah.
Right?
I like that. Yeah, I like it. And of course, as is always the case, you know, what we're doing to the environment is partly why this is happening. Habitat loss and bushmeat consumption bring humans in closer contact with wildlife. Large commercial wildlife markets that exist in China and Southeast Asia bring humans in contact with live animals that are kept in unsanitary conditions, thereby compounding the risk of disease transmission. Habitat loss has an indirect and significant role in disease outbreaks. So yeah, we're screwed.
Don't bat heckle and cut back on your bushmeat consumption.
Yeah, exactly. Which both of those things are going to have a real impact on me. And Matt, you were complaining about how people are taking extreme measures that are really disruptive. And so I don't know how I'm going to be able to do either of those things.
Yeah, I don't. I'm already upset about being bushmeat shamed.
Yeah. What is bushmeat? I don't know what bushmeat is.
It's like in some countries when people eat like very wild game, it can be monkeys, apes, whatever. Oh. Like they're eating things that you wouldn't typically think of as
edible,
agricultural. Yeah, exactly. Like they're, yeah.
And that's because of like customs or because of disruptive.
It's by custom. It's you know, due to the fact that they're living in areas where they don't have access to, you know, processed foods. So, this is one of the theories about how HIV came about, is because it was originally SIV and people, yeah. So who knows? So.
From monkeys?
Yeah, simian immune.
Before it was GRID, gay-related virus, immune deficiency. Remember that? You were alive then. So was I, but I wasn't as old as you.
I was, yes. Yeah.
Did you remember being called GRID?
I do. Yep. No. Gay-related immunodeficiency syndrome.
Yeah.
I remember all that. I also remember how incredibly long it took for people to freak out about it. But then
there was
a moment, and it's funny because I was talking to, I have a relative who worked at one of the big networks and was talking about how there was a moment in time where they were doing one AIDS story on a Monday, and by Wednesday it was three AIDS stories, and then by Friday with the whole the whole block was AIDS stories. And so these things, they do reach like a moment when everything hits critical mass. It just happens faster in today's environment.
And of course, Reagan like famously did not mention it until very late
It took them forever, right? But of course, it was a different population of people who was getting the disease. So they didn't care as much. All right, so lots to get to this week, politics-wise. Obviously, has not been a great run for Bernie Sanders. The debate, which we watched together drunkenly, was a bit of a fiasco. Well, it wasn't a fiasco, but Biden was much more coherent than he usually was. Add to that the results of the primaries that probably shouldn't have happened, and you get headlines like the one in Vox, which says that Biden has essentially won the nomination. He has a virtually insurmountable lead. He's above 1,000 delegates. But I think the debate, I don't know if you agree with me, but the debate, I think, has brought to the forefront the sort of biggest problem with Biden, in addition to his declining mental state, which I think it's fair to say that, it's just his unbelievable fluidity in lying. It reaches a critical mass at some point. He's just completely shameless about it. I mean, on a Trumpian level, am I wrong?
No, yeah. I mean, we should go through it. Someone should make a mashup video about it. But yeah, it is a Trumpian level. But it's in some ways actually scarier, because whereas Trump doesn't really particularly pretend to be honest, Biden does. Like, that's the thing. This is a stable, you know, Trump calls himself a stable genius, but no one actually believes he's either of those things. Whereas people do think of Biden, despite his gaffes, as a reliable, you know, statesman who is not an unprecedented threat. Did you ask on Twitter what drugs both candidates were? You did a Twitter poll, right? Asking what drugs
people thought the candidates might be on. And by that, basically, we were mainly talking about Biden, but the overwhelming results, I think the four choices were Vyvanse, modafinil, Ritalin, and
Adderall.
Right. Overwhelmingly, I think, Dan, if you look, the poll results are there. Actually, interesting results. So look at this. We had 2,635 votes, and 53.2% of the people voted for Adderall. Then there was modafinil came in third, I guess. Ritalin was second, and Vyvanse was fourth. But it was close. It was similar to the Democratic field earlier this year. Before we press on from the debate, we should just talk about some of the things that he said in the debate. And just to give an example of Biden's sort of fluidity in saying absolute untruths. I think there's an issue here where one of the reasons I think he gets off on this a little bit is because people don't know, is he lying or does he not remember? It's not always clear. And sometimes it feels like it's a little bit of both. And I think that dulls the impact of it a little bit, but there were amazing things that he said in this debate, just totally amazing. Okay, so he was very, very aggressive in talking about his record on immigration. And here's a point of the debate where he pledged that if he were president, the only deportations would be of people who committed felonies. And let's take a look at this.
In the first 100 days of my administration, no one will be deported at all. From that point on, the only deportations that will take place are commissions of felonies in the United States of America.
So to be clear, only felons get deported and everyone else
Period.
Has to stay.
Yes. Yes.
So he says that. And then there's another question where Ilya Calderon asks him what his policy would be on people who are picked up and whether they'd be deported.
Where do you stand now? Should undocumented immigrants arrested by local police be turned over to immigration officials?
No.
So people may not remember just exactly how ferocious Biden was on immigration for most of his career. I mean, if you go back and actually listen to the way Biden talked about this issue once upon a time, it's amazing. It's basically indistinguishable from Donald Trump. Let's look at a video of Biden from 2006. This is amazing.
Greatest disparity in wealth. It's one of the wealthiest countries in the hemisphere. And because of a corrupt system that exists in Mexico, there is the 1% of the population at the top, a very small middle class, and the rest is abject poverty. Folks, I voted for a fence. I voted, unlike most Democrats, and some of you won't like it, I voted for 700-mile fence. But let me tell you, we can build a fence 40 stories high, unless you change the dynamic in Mexico. And you will not like this, and punish American employers who knowingly violate the law when in fact they hire illegals. Unless you do those two things, all the rest is window dressing. The reason why I, parenthetically, why I believe the fence is needed is not related to immigration as much as the drugs. I'm the guy that wrote the National Crime Bill. I'm the guy that wrote the National Drug Act. I'm the guy that wrote the law that set up a drug czar. But let me tell you something, folks. People are driving across that border with tons of everything from byproducts from methamphetamine to cocaine to heroin. It's all coming up through corrupt Mexico.
How is that meaningfully different from they're bringing the worst people?
Oh, you mean rapists and drug dealers or rapists
they're
and criminals?
They're bringing murderers.
Murderers.
And you know, tons and tons of methamphetamine, coke, and heroin. I listened to Trump give that exact same speech countless times in 2016. He's talking about building a fence. You could build it 40 stories high, but it still wouldn't be enough because you have to not only deport people, but you have to go and punish the people who hire illegals.
Right, right.
So it completely contradicts what he's just said about, when people get stopped by ICE, you know, and they're undocumented, are they going to be turned over? No. I mean, he says that in the debate. He's just completely lying.
Right. I mean, to play devil's advocate, he could have evolved, but he wouldn't need to have said that, right? I mean, it's such a significant turnaround that he should have been pressed on that and asked about that and said, so your position is different from when you said build that fence, basically. It's just a great metaphor for, it's like he's slightly less offensive than Trump, right? Like he doesn't call them rapists and murderers. They're just drug addicts and drug dealers.
Yeah, no, but he's incredibly aggressive on this issue. And he, you know, talking again, remember, he wants to criminally punish not just the people who are here illegally, but also the people who hire them, right? So he said that. Then this there's amazing, amazing passage when Bernie confronts him about his Social Security views, and he talks about how it's a flat lie. Yeah.
One second, sorry. Also, read the immigrant thing. I gotta give him credit for being consistent in one thing. He calls them illegals then, and he called them aliens in this
right.
debate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And just quickly about that, about the whole evolving thing. Like let's just say theoretically he has evolved, and he does recognize that maybe he was wrong, or that it's the political necessity of changing your views on immigration. Those prior statements where he's so heated and he's so emotional about it, that shows you where his heart is or was at one time. So that's an important indicator of how hard a person is or is not going to press on an issue. And look, immigration is a complicated issue. And I mean, there's lots and lots of positions you can take in between completely open borders and putting up a wall. But he was pretty far on the side of let's just keep all of corrupt Mexico, as he put it out. All right, let's look at the Social Security, which was just as bad, I think.
My Lord, Bernie, you're running ads saying I'm opposed to Social Security that PolitiFact says is a flat lie and that the Washington Post said is a flat lie.
Oh, well, let me ask you a question, Joe.
Yeah.
You're right here with me.
Yeah.
Have you been on the floor of the Senate? You were in the Senate for a few years.
Yeah.
Time and time again, talking about the necessity with pride about cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, cutting veterans programs.
No.
You never said that.
No.
All right. America, go to the website right now. Go to the YouTube right now. Time after time, you were not a fan of Bo Simpson?
I was not a fan of Bo Simpson.
You were not a fan of the balanced budget amendment, which called for cuts in Social Security? Come on, Joe, you won't.
Look, here's the deal.
You're an honest guy. Why don't you just tell the truth here? We all make mistakes.
Okay, let's hear what Biden said once upon a time. This is back in the 90s.
When I argued that we should freeze federal spending, I meant Social Security as well. I meant Medicare and Medicaid. I meant veterans benefits. I meant every single solitary thing in the government. And I not only tried it once, I tried it twice, I tried it a third time, and I tried it a fourth time.
So there he is, and he's repeatedly, over and over again, and this is the thing with Biden, he often, I remember some of these speeches back in the day, he always positioned himself as where other Democrats wouldn't go, I'm willing to go. When we talk about balancing the budget, I'm willing to make the hard choices. So he's repeatedly talked about cutting Social Security. Everything is on the table. You see how how emotional he gets about these things. And then he just stands up there and there's two things here. He must know that this video is out there, but he's assuming that he's not going to be punished for it by the press and by PolitiFact and by all these fact-checking organizations that are going to carry his water for him. It's like atrocious, right?
It's really disgusting. And I don't know why I get where Sanders, I feel like that's such a relatable feeling where he's like, come on. Oh, come on. Just tell the truth, Joe. Like, we all make mistakes. But why? He's not honest, Biden. Biden's not honest. And I think Bernie like can't get over whatever rapport that they have. I mean, also, it was kind of endearing when he's like, oh, really? You don't want to cut Social Security? Then, everyone, after this debate, go to the YouTube.
Yeah, the YouTube, the internets. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The internets. Like, what? He should have had a quote. He really should have had a quote. I don't know why he didn't just read one of these quotes. It really was frustrating. All he would have had to have done, forget the Paul Ryan one, which people, oh my God, that sounded like I was rapping. And I immediately thought of the Baby Got Back in my head. But forget the Paul Ryan thing, which people can like, I mean, Bernie's people are right that he was siding with Paul Ryan. But fine, if you want to say that there's a nuance in the rhetoric, but just go back to one of these. Just say that. Just literally quote it. Why didn't he quote it?
He should have had a sheet in front of him full of Biden's statements that actually what he should have done is announced at the beginning of the debate that whenever Joe lies about something, I'm going to pull this out, you know, the first time he did it.
Or go like wag the finger and then people, because Joe's a dude, so no one can pretend he's being sexist or misogynist.
Exactly. But it didn't, none of that stunted Biden at all. He kept going.
He's malarkey. He himself is the biggest malarkey candidate.
Total malarkey. And so here he is talking about the bankruptcy bill. Here's a video that's where we see him talking about the bankruptcy bill in the debate, and then we immediately see afterwards statements from the Senate floor contradicting what he said.
This is a little bit about leadership as well. Joe talked about bankruptcy. Joe, if my memory is correct, you helped write that bankruptcy bill.
I did not.
All right.
Senators Biden and Carper have worked tirelessly for years on this legislation, and they've taken some tough votes to get it done, and I admire them for it. You would expect senators from Delaware, which is the corporate state, to do their best to get this bill through, but they did.
A few moments ago, we completed action on the bankruptcy bill. I want to particularly thank all of our colleagues for the work on the bill, in particular Senator Grassley and Senator Hatch, Senator Sessions, and others on both sides of the aisle who've been working on this legislation for lo these many years. 7 or 8 years, I was told by Senator Biden a while ago.
I spent a lot of time on the Hill in 2006. I did a bunch of stories on Congress, on the response to, response to the Katrina disaster. And it was, everybody knew that Biden was leading the Democratic side of the bankruptcy bill. He came from the credit card company state. He had long-standing ties to MBNA, which was one of the big players in this legislation, because the credit card companies were driving this awful bill. And for people who don't know what the bankruptcy bill was about, it was designed to make it impossible for people to declare bankruptcy to get out of a consumer credit debt. So while you can be Donald Trump and walk away from a project and not pay for it and then have your business declare bankruptcy later, if you run up $25,000 in credit card debt because you want to pay for groceries for your kids or whatever it is, you can't get out of that. It will follow you around like herpes for the rest of your life, right? It's a virus you cannot get rid of. It was one of the most evil bills we've ever passed, because it's completely discriminatory and it creates a total double standard. And Biden... And you have to give credit to
No pun intended.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Who was the first Republican in that bill? That was
Orrin Hatch.
Orrin Hatch was saying, yeah, well, you would expect the person from Delaware to vote for this bill. He was basically saying, yeah, of course, Biden's voting for it because he's paid for by the credit card industry. But totally shameful. I mean, and for him to just be like, I did not.
Again,
he knows that no one's going to beat him up on this, you know,
I got to say, oh, by the way, and Carper, right? They named Carper, who, of course, is the one who, isn't he the one who gave
the recommendation to Hunter, yeah.
To Hunter to be on the board of Amtrak as someone who takes Amtrak.
That's yeah, Hunter Biden rides a lot of Amtrak trains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, some of you may have noticed that I somewhat appreciate Bernie Sanders. I'm on the fence in this primary, but I'm leaning Bernie.
I'm teetering,
yeah. I have to say, this was the first time I was really kind of angry at Sanders. Like I was, and it reminded me, Matt, of what you said a couple episodes ago, where you're like, he has to, when you, based on your piece saying that he had to be more on the offensive and basically up like, not just keep growing his campaign as is, but adapting to how what you have to do when it gets bigger. And you of course quoted some a Sanders person saying that it's like Steve Martin's character in The Jerk, where when he gets a lot of money, he just builds a bigger shack. Mm-hmm. He starts out poor. And I was just like, and you said, you know, he's people are believing in him. They're putting their energy in him. They're giving him lots of money, but he needs to like have his shit prepared and he needs to bring the receipts and needs to say, Biden, you said ABC on in 19, whatever. And just, he could have and should have just really cornered him ideologically in as a liar that he is.
Absolutely. And more than that, he had to, you know, I think he needed to make what, you know, an apostrophic address to the voters at the time. And you have to say, this man is lying to you. Not only that, he's a symbol of what the Democratic Party has done for decades. They pretend to be one thing, and then when they get into office, they do another thing. And over again, this has happened, and he's the perfect symbol of this, right? I mean, he had to say something like that, and you're absolutely right. He needed to have chapter and verse, and just batter him with it, because it's abundantly clear that the moderators are going to let him get away with it.
And, so pathetic. And what's apostrophic? I mean,
apostrophe, like a direct address. You know,
why is that apostrophe? Isn't apostrophe like owning something, like possessive? Anyway, I believe
I just meant that, you know, while you're in the middle of the debate, like there's a moment in time where you have to shift
the
camera and say, folks,
right,
this is what he's doing, you know, like, and Trump is really good at that. I mean,
of course.
You have to sum it up and give it to people in like a bite-sized portion and make sure that they can't escape what the reality of what they're watching.
Wouldn't it be funny if he was like, folks, he's a liar. He's a liar, folks. If he said it like Trump. People already compare him to Trump, so he might as well just totally lift his
own effect. Own it. Exactly. And anyway, there were a few more. He again dissembled about his Iraq record, and he also did it in an interview with Lawrence O'Donnell just prior to the debate. I think we should look at that too, just to recap this.
You say that your vote on the Iraq war was based on the president's, Bush's representations, that this wasn't about going to war. It was about presenting a clear, at least, threat to Saddam Hussein. Bernie Sanders says, I saw right through that. I was right. I knew what George Bush was up to. When we look back on it, can we say that Senator Sanders' judgment about that was better than yours?
Look, the reason I voted the way I did was to try to prevent a war from happening because, remember, the threat was to go to war. The argument was because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. So he said that I need to be able to get the Security Council to agree to send in inspectors to put pressure on Saddam to find out whether or not he's producing nuclear weapons. And at the time, I said, that's your reason. All right, I get it. That was the rationale was, that's the way to not go to war, because I didn't believe he had those nuclear weapons. I didn't believe he had those weapons of mass destruction.
So he says, I didn't believe they had weapons of mass destruction. Let's hear what he said at the time.
Other countries have or seek weapons of mass destruction. Saddam has actually used them against his neighbors, against his own people. He has a lengthy track record of aggression, first in Iran, then Kuwait, He has brutally repressed Iraqi civilians, first the Kurds in the north, then the Shias in the south, then the Kurds again. And the combination of Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction is dangerous, destabilizing, and deadly. Ultimately, either those weapons must be dislodged from Iraq or Saddam must be dislodged from power.
I feel like he's dangerous, destabilizing, and deadly, and needs to be dislodged from the primary.
Does that sound like somebody who's just really anxious to get inspectors in there to see if he has weapons of mass destruction? So, you know.
So wait, can you just outline the lie? So where I'm trying to catalog the lies just on this one lie about Iraq.
Well, saying, okay.
Yeah.
So
it's because it's so multi-layered.
The problem with his lies about Iraq is that he's had about 19 different positions on. They evolve almost literally every time he talks about the issue. And we should talk about that because that's worse than Hillary, who's had evolving positions on this issue. He doesn't even seem to be able to keep track of the things that he said about this issue. So just to take an example, he's been saying for a year now that he was opposed to the war before it started. Someone who's a friend of mine, Michael Tracy, approached Joe at an event in September, and this is what he said.
Why have you been saying you were against the Iraq war when you helped Bush and Cheney make the case in 02 and 03? Everybody can remember.
No. If you look what actually happened, Dick Lugar and I had a proposal to make it difficult for him to use force. And the reason why it went in is that what happened was, the argument was he needed, and I believed him. I was wrong. I believed him when he said he wasn't going to use force. It was just to get the Security Council to force inspectors in to see whether there was any nuclear activity going on with Saddam Hussein. And that's what he did.
But you didn't oppose the war before it began.
Yes, I did oppose the war before it began.
Very clear. He's saying, I did oppose the war before it began. But he clearly says in that, and he said it multiple times in the course of the last year, that I opposed the war before it began. However, we have this video. Dan, if you could look at the one that we originally wanted to queue up there, 9 months after the war.
9 months ago, I voted with my colleagues to give the President of the United States of America the authority to use force. And I would vote that way again today. It was a right vote then, and it'd be a correct vote today.
So, to say that he has an evolving position on this is generous. He just says whatever he thinks in the moment is going to be received the best, which is exactly the kind of thing we've been criticizing Trump for the last 4 years. And so this is a person who does this over and over and over again about every conceivable issue.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that he was an up and coming politician who was headed for the presidency maybe in 1988. When his whole political career was derailed because he serially has a problem with this. And just the last clip I want to show is one which I think is really illustrative because it just speaks to his inability to keep track of all the different things that he says. Here's one talking about his educational background.
Explaining to do, the new questions stem from with taped remarks of Biden States. During an April campaign appearance in New Hampshire.
I went to law school on a full academic scholarship, the only one in my class to have a full academic scholarship. Went back to law school and, in fact, ended up in the top half of my class. I was the outstanding student in the political science department at the end of my year. I graduated with 3 degrees from undergraduate school and 165 credits, only needed 123 credits.
Biden now concedes he did not graduate in the top half of his law school class, that he does not have 3 degrees from college, and that he was not named outstanding political science student in college.
Newsweek says Biden actually went to school on a half scholarship, ended up near the bottom of his class, and won only 1 degree, not 3.
Joe Biden ranked 76th in a class of 85 at the University of Syracuse Law School. I mean, this guy comes off this whole thing as a flyweight.
Now Biden says Newsweek is right. His memory had failed him.
Yeah, so back then he's saying, oh, he misremembered. How do you misremember all those different things? And you know, he has told evolving stories about everything from the giving the medal to the person in Afghanistan to being arrested in South Africa to the plagiarizing speeches from Neil Kinnock. I mean, like, this guy is unable to keep straight the things that he says. And I don't know how you feel about it. I think he just doesn't know. Like, I think he has a problem.
Hmm.
Like, yeah, he tells himself stories about this stuff, in addition to being cynical and just lying like any politician would.
Right. So the question is like whether he's definitely disingenuous. And then the question is also whether he's like deluding himself or decompensating or a combination of all of those things.
Right.
But either, you know, the thing is, and we talk about this a lot and people don't get this, like Dems, a lot of Democrats or quote unquote liberals, progressives don't get this, which is that Trump will absolutely kill Biden on this. Like he will absolutely decimate him during debates about this. And then when you say that, people say, yeah, but Trump's a liar too. But again, totally different standard. The threshold of honesty is totally different. Trump's hypocrisy is not hypocritical. Biden's hypocrisy is hypocritical. Basically, all Dems' hypocrisy is hypocritical because they are, especially now, running as the honest, you know, like traditional, normalcy candidates against this guy who is a total aberration and a nut job and, you know, mentally unstable. He will, I mean, we saw him do this with Hillary Clinton on her super predator remarks during a debate, which is like hilarious because this is a guy who wanted to reinstate the death penalty around the Central Park Five guys. He's a racist, but it doesn't matter because he pokes holes in people's armor. And that may have been a mixed metaphor anyway, but people will, this will not be good. Like this will not be good. And Trump will bring it up. And I mean, to be fair, maybe Biden is a fluent enough liar that he'll just be able to. But I kind of think he won't be able to, because I think Trump, unlike Bernie, will do a really good job of nailing him and putting him in the corner.
He'll be a lot crueler about it, that's for sure. And yeah. and he will say to his face, like, you know, Joe, what's the matter? Don't you remember? I mean, yeah. it'll be nasty. You know, Trump is vulnerable on the lies that he tells, but he's vulnerable in a way that the Democrats won't, that somebody like Biden won't take advantage of. I mean, he'll say, you know, Trump pledging to reverse the free trade agreements, to pitching himself as somebody who was going to end the pointless wars and overseas, but right. would actually increase the bombing. All those are issues that the Democrats don't want to go near, you know? So
I feel like Biden would go near those actually, because he lies so much that even if he wouldn't, he'd just lie and pretend that he wasn't for those things.
Right.
But I still think that Trump will be able to highlight his dishonesty in a way that Bernie wouldn't. Not because he couldn't, but just didn't for whatever reasons. And that it'll just, I don't know how vulnerable Trump is to that stuff. As we all saw, like, as he said, he could shoot someone on,
Fifth Avenue, right. I don't know. I mean, I guess a thing that's frustrating to me, and I share what you said about your frustration about the press, like, there once upon a time, and we saw this with Biden himself, if you lie on camera, and you look directly into a camera and lie, that used to be just disqualifying for a politician. We caught you doing this and you know, that's it. You're out. It's no longer a problem. I mean, we're in this post-truth society, and for the same news organizations that have devoted entire sections of their company to counting all the different misstatements and lies that Donald Trump has made are just letting this fly, right?
I mean, yeah.
I just don't understand it. Like,
yeah, I think that I expect this from Biden. It's like, it's reprehensible, and it's a stain on I don't want to say stain, because that implies that like without it would be pristine or something. But the more frustrating thing is the media's complicity.
Right.
Then, because we do expect politicians to lie. And as you said, like, there was a time when the media was better on this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. They were better. I mean, they were shallower, but they went over after people. You know, they tended not to care if somebody had a changed position on some important issue. But, you know, if you lied about your educational background, or if you stole a speech from somebody, or, you know, that used to be fatal, you know, and the people who used to follow candidates around, they had a little bit of a standard. Like, we wouldn't let just a complete jackass through, you know, not without some serious abuse anyway, you know, and now they just, you know, there's just no standard anymore for this kind of stuff. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you keep going.
For all of Bernie's flaws, and he has some, like, he does check the box of somebody who has integrity about the things that he says. You know, he doesn't have personal failings. You know, there aren't affairs, there aren't financial misdealings in the background. These are all things that campaign journalists traditionally care a lot about. You know, we dug through your records if we found something. You know, even John Kerry, they nearly sank Kerry's campaign over an affair that apparently didn't happen. You know, so they'll go after those things. They don't do it anymore. And Biden is just he's just a gigantic red flag, and I just don't understand it.
So tell us about the results, Matt. What do they mean? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, virus notwithstanding, thanks to Tom Perez, we did have some results. Arizona, Florida, and Illinois the results are all in. Biden won all those states. Belatedly, we finally got the results for Washington State, and Biden won that. Finally, the results for California are in, and Sanders did win that, finally. But at this point, Biden has a lead of what they're calling insurmountable. It's over 1,000 delegates. So he's, even though Bernie still has a considerable number of delegates, it'd be very, very difficult. It would take a catastrophic event at this point for Bernie to really catch up. So,
but it's not insurmountable. It's just very unlikely.
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be like a thing where Biden is almost like not on the ballot in some of those states, basically. I mean, he would have to lose by a landslide in a bunch of the states coming up, which is not terribly likely. But so the whole complexion of the race really changed in the last 3 weeks of votes. It's, you know, it's really basically a done deal at this point.
No. No, I refuse to accept that. So obviously all these people have been calling for him to drop out even more. But what is the strategic, like what would be a justification for Sanders staying in the race?
Because he's building a movement. It's the same reason he stayed in last time. He's got to stay in. He's got to get the maximum amount of leverage. And right. I think the argument they're going to make is that him staying in is going to hurt Biden in the general election. But that's actually not the case. The more aggressive that Sanders is now, it will actually help, theoretically, it would help Biden in the end, because he would have to confront all those things going forward.
Before he would with Trump.
Right, exactly. And also, I think from a longer range point of view, it's just the right thing to do.
Me too.
Biden he's an unacceptable candidate. And there's a lot of things that, you know, there's probably some reporting that's yet to come about that this guy, but just in terms of his positions and his inability to tell the truth about things and, you know, his condition, it would be wrong for Bernie to drop out while there's any glint of a chance, for him to still win it. And, you know, it's not over in the sense that Biden hasn't sewn up the supermajority. He hasn't sewn up the 1,991 votes. So he's got to stay in. I don't know what you think about that.
Oh, I wonder what Katie thinks about whether Bernie should
drum
stay
roll
in.
Suspense,
yeah.
Right?
Well, he did. I mean, it's true. The thing is, like, he moved Hillary and the platform to a more progressive platform. And not just that, but he was urging, she of course ignored it, but he wanted them to oppose TPP, like to put down the platform. And of course she didn't. But what is the, like, I don't really understand the leverage of having delegates if you're not gonna get all of them.
Well, especially if Biden doesn't get 1,991 delegates. If he doesn't win on the first ballot, he'll win on the second ballot, but it's still important, you know, symbolically, it's important to have as much power as you can going into the convention. It'll give you more say in who gets to be in charge of what committees, who's writing the platform, all that stuff.
And shows your political mandate.
And remember, Bernie, ultimately the leverage that Bernie has to learn how to exercise is the threat that my people are not going to be there.
Right. He should threaten. I hope behind closed doors he's threatening third party.
Yeah, I mean, it might come to that, right? And certainly, he's making a mistake by saying I'm gonna on day one campaign for Biden. It's a huge mistake. He can't do that.
And saying he's electable against Trump.
Right. And for the people who are gonna freak out about that, we have to reiterate this point. Why do people like James Carville spend their lives worrying about moderates? Because everyone knows moderates will go to the Republican Party if they don't like the platform. And nobody worries about that with progressives because they know progressives are in pocket. They're going to end up voting for the Democrat. That reality has to change if people want to have something change within the party. They have to threaten to take their vote somewhere else, or at least sit it out. Otherwise, you know, all those delegates don't mean anything.
Right. We had to scare. Yeah, they have to be scared into thinking that there's consequences.
Right.
And that they can't just take these voters for granted, even on the off chance that Sanders doesn't win the primary.
Right. And that can't be a bluff either. Like, it has to be real. Like, he has to really think that way, which I don't think he does yet. So
maybe what our role on Useful Idiots is, we can every week we discourage people. We ask people to pledge to not vote for Biden in the general. That would make us really beloved.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. Well, it'll win us lots of love on social media.
Yeah.
So anyway, lots of stuff this week. Lots of it. Most of it terrible. Actually, all of it universally just horrible to an unbelievable degree.
This whole episode should be called "Isn't That Terrible?"
Yeah, yeah. What wasn't that extremely terrible?
Yeah,
yeah. All right, so we have a great interview.
Wow. Yeah. On that note,
with a brilliant man, Noam Chomsky, the esteemed public intellectual of American life, great thinker, great political thinker, great oppositionist,
linguist,
and we had a terrific conversation with him. Terrific. Thanks so much for doing this. We're all in quarantine.
You're in quarantine?
Yes. They sent us home today, so we're working remotely. Trying to be as respectful as we can of your time, so we'll just dive right into it if that's okay, Professor. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thing.
Wondering, first of all, are there any lessons to be learned from what happened to the Sanders campaign? And did you at any moment think that he actually might succeed and win the nomination?
I was skeptical as to whether he'd have a chance. I thought it after Iowa, and I thought maybe there was a chance, but it seemed in Nevada. But it has always seemed to me a long shot. Now, for one thing, there's a overwhelming establishment opposition. I mean, the media. The critique and condemnations were very powerful. And I noticed that as soon as it looked that he was fading, then they started to get complimentary articles about what a nice guy he is and so on. But that was after it became pretty clear that he wasn't going to win. He had hoped plainly and said that there would be an upsurge of young voters. That didn't happen. There's a strong youth support for him, but it didn't show up at the voting booth. It's easier to appear at a demonstration than to do something old-fashioned, like to walk into a voting booth, and it's not what young people do. Now, the other thing which I've felt all along is that in this country, which is a very strange country, it doesn't make much sense to use the word socialist. In every other country of the world that I know of, it's like a Democrat, It's not. But here, after decades and decades of almost 100 years now of massive propaganda vilifying the concept, people just don't know what it means. It means the gulag, something like that. We don't want that. My feeling all along was that what he should have done is just kind of out of character, but what he should have done is say, look, I'm an old-fashioned New Dealer. I'm one of the United States to the level of other similar countries, all of which have some form of universal health care. And free higher education. I think we can do that too. Now, here's the way we ought to do it. That's two main points. Because it's basically saying, let's try to be like everyone else. In the case of education, let's try to be the way we were 60 years ago, 70 years ago. Much poorer country, but we had essentially free higher education. It's called the GI Bill, which gave not only free education, but even subsidized education to great numbers of people who never would otherwise. It was very good for them, very good for the country.
Professor, I know you've compared Bernie's politics to Dwight Eisenhower in the past. Were you amazed, A, that they were so successful in painting him as such a radical, and B, that he kind of went along with it? I mean, using the revolutionary terminology, it seemed like he helped in marketing himself as being more extreme than he really was?
Well, I think it's a combination of Sanders' understandable description of himself as a democratic socialist in most of the world, in fact, almost all the world outside of dictatorships. That's just a normal position. I don't know of any other country where a person has to apologize for being called a socialist. People run as communists in elections. But the United States is a very strange country. It went berserk in 1917. You read back the Wilson administration's response to the Bolshevik Revolution. It was sheer fury. The Bolsheviks are trying to put the ignorant and stupid masses in control and all over the world. Leading historians like John Lewis Gaddis, who's the most respected Cold War historian, liberal historian, in retrospect, writes that the West had to move directly to try to crush the Bolshevik Revolution because they were threatening the entire world with their aggressive challenge to introduce social reform. So what could we do but defend ourselves? I mean, that's the liberal end of the academic establishment. You go to elsewhere, it's crazy. And this gets continually renewed in called the McCarthy period, actually started by Truman, total hysteria. On and on, you know, the Chinese are coming over to Congress. This just goes on and on. In fact, it goes way back in American history with other, back to the merciless Indian savages who are destroying us, Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. It's a very frightened country. It's been off the spectrum on this issue for many years. So to use the word socialist is, anywhere else in the world, it's normal, but here that comes with a lot of baggage. On the other hand, if Sanders had said, look, I'm a New Deal Democrat, I want to carry forward the New Deal programs that were strongly supported by people like Dwight Eisenhower, who said, if you're not a New Deal, if you don't accept the New Deal, you don't belong in our political system, and so on. It's been a regression in the last 30, 40 years. So let's go back to sane policies. My main policies, the major ones I'm advancing, are universal health care and free higher education. Practically every other country in the world has something like that. The countries with the most successful educational systems, Finland, Germany, France, others, have free higher education. Even poorer countries like Mexico have it at quite a high quality. We had it ourselves back in the 1950s, 1960s. It was called the GI Bill, which provided free higher education, subsidized education to huge numbers of people who never would have gone to college. It was very good for them. It was very good for the country. We should certainly, we have a health system which is an international scandal. It's twice the cost of comparable countries, relatively poor outcomes. The reason is it's the only one that's privatized, huge administrative costs, advertising costs, enormous salaries, all kinds of inefficiency. So let's get rid of it and be a much better country if we move in this direction. Now, there are various ways of doing it. Here's my proposals, you know, okay. But something has to be done to try to educate the country to understand that paying $10 to a private corporation is worse than paying $5 in taxes. The hatred of taxes that's been engendered here is a remarkable fact. So there's plenty of people who are scared of rising taxes to pay for, you know, healthcare for all. and would prefer to pay twice that much to private insurers who, you know, cut them off at the pass when they need support and so on. It's an astonishing fact, and it tells you something about the way the ideological system here has fostered the money. That should be understood. Take taxes. Just think about it for a minute. I suppose you had a totalitarian state. Come April 9th, they're stealing your money from you. You don't want to pay it. Suppose you had a democratic society. Let's just imagine that.
We'll try.
Yeah, suspend disbelief.
In a thought experiment.
Yeah.
In a democratic society, people would get together, deliberate, say, here we want our community for our country, work out the ways of paying for it. April 15th is a day of celebration. We've gotten together, we've decided what we want, we're going to pay for it. Great, everything's wonderful. Now just see where the United States ranks on that spectrum between democracy and totalitarianism. The internal conception that people have is as if we were in a totalitarian society. They, up there, we have nothing to do with, are coming to steal our money, okay? The idea, and it's kind of intriguing that, you know, you can read in the pundits, the commentators, we're a wonderful democratic society, but we hate taxes, okay? Death and taxes, they go together. A little contradiction. Simply the attitude towards taxes, meaning paying for what we want ourselves, we paying for what we want, is a dramatic illustration of how hatred of democracy at a deep level has been engendered by a century, actually, of propaganda. It was different during the New Deal period. But during the neoliberal period, a very prominent part of the propaganda system starts with Reagan's little quips, his sunny little smile about how government is the problem, you know, and so on and so forth. Or Thatcher more seriously saying, there is no society, just individuals. So if they get your money from you, they're stealing. You know, the neoliberal economists, taxes are theft, you know. All of this has sunk in to popular consciousness in a deep way. Now, Sanders, of course, would be facing the problem. Any person would be facing the problem of trying to unravel layer after layer of propaganda that has changed consciousness, what Gramsci called hegemonic common sense. You know, it's just like the air you breathe. You can't even think about it. I mean, what I said about taxes is not quantum theory. If you think for 5 seconds, it's obvious. But does anybody say it? If people say it, it sounds like they come from Mars. You know? But it's perfectly elementary and obvious. Just as it's obvious that we ought to be able to rise to the level of other countries. In fact, we see it in the third world character of our infrastructure. It's shocking. The richest country in history is infrastructure, which is unbelievably backwards. And we're facing it right now with take the coronavirus. Mm. What's happening here is shocking. People can't get tested. There's no tests available. Hospitals don't have beds. Why don't they have beds? Because there's a concept of economy and efficiency. You should have just enough beds for what you need tomorrow. You shouldn't prepare for the future, right? So yeah, the hospital system's crashing. The simple things like tests, which you can easily get in a country like South Korea, you can't get here. So the coronavirus, which should be controlled in a functioning society, is going out of hand here. We're just not ready for it. What we're good at, what our leaders are good at and have been very good at for the last 40 years is pouring money into the pockets of the rich in the corporate sector while everything else crashes. Okay, now we're facing the consequences in consciousness, in awareness of the nature of the society, in policies, even in the ability to respond to what is plainly a serious problem, could be catastrophe if we can't handle it.
Doesn't this get to sort of to your bailiwick with the media, though? I mean, all of these things, it's a relatively simple educational task to explain to people what the equation is with healthcare. For instance, you say, it's, would you rather pay $10 to Aetna and Humana, or would you rather pay $5 to the US government? But how are you going to get there? We just had an election where the public overwhelmingly seems to want Medicare for all. You had a candidate who was very clear on the issue, but there was so much propaganda from the cable networks, which whose chief advertisers happen to be pharmaceutical companies. How does anybody get past that with that structure in place?
Well, not simple, but you have to get back to the core of it. It's not just the cable, the New York Times. Medicare, healthcare for all is going to raise taxes. Okay, it's going to raise taxes and cut back private expenses by far more than it raises taxes. Okay, that's why our healthcare system is so ludicrously expensive. Yes, low taxes and rotten healthcare and huge expenses. So that part of the story has to be brought to people. Now, it's not going to be easy for people who are spending their lives watching Sean Hannity, or for that matter, reading op-eds in New York Times, to be honest. But that has to be done, and has to be done at a grassroots level. That means real serious education, a major process to try to change the level of kind of civilization in the country is very hard. And it's not just that issue, every issue. So take really existential crises, not just rotten healthcare, but the likelihood that organized human society won't survive for a couple of generations. That's pretty serious after all. Yeah, and that's happening. You take a look at public attitudes on that. I'm talking about what's called politely climate change, the climate burning, the global warming, the world burning up. What are the public attitudes? They're very striking. It turns out that there's a recent Pew poll on this, that the concern over global warming is increasing, but it's increasing in a subpart of the population called Democrats. If you take a look at Republicans, roughly half the population, it's very low and hasn't changed. The idea that it's a serious problem stays at about 25% change. Why? Because that's what they're hearing. You take a look at other studies, it turns out that you ask what media sources are people looking at, do they know about and trust? There was a recent study of about 30 media outlets, print, TV, the whole range. Among Democrats, it's most of them. Among Republicans, it's really Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, and Breitbart. Okay, if that's your source of news, everything's fine. All you have to do is trust in our dear leader, and everything will go away. Well, as long as people are immersed in that kind of alternative world, there's going to be a lot of work to do to break through, and it's possible. So, for example, among younger Republicans, it's changing. Okay, they're the future. They can be reached, others can be reached with simple arguments like the kind we've been made. Not, I'm a socialist, I'm going to send you to the gulag, but let's become like we were 50 years ago and have free higher education, like Dwight Eisenhower supported, quote Eisenhower. Now, these are ways of reaching people. You have to face people where they are, not where you think they ought to be. And it's not that they're people. Is that this is what you're immersed in. Not only your life, but your parents' lives and your grandparents' lives. We see this on just about everything. Ask people today what's in the Constitution. Half the people will say what's in the Constitution is your right to have assault rifles. Okay, Second Amendment, is the only part of the Constitution most people even know exists. Where does that come from? Well, you can educate people about that. It's a con. It's a literally a con. The first great public relations triumph in this era of public relations was a massive campaign by the gun manufacturers back in the late 19th century when they were losing their market after the Civil War. You know, you didn't need sophisticated rifles. Other countries weren't buying them anymore. It was an agricultural country, so farmers had, you know, a cheap musket to chase away coyotes or something, but they didn't want the stuff that the gun manufacturer were producing. So they started a huge campaign in which they concocted a completely fictitious story of the Wild West, you know, with sheriffs fast on the draw and Wild Bill Hickok and all this stuff. Complete con. None of it ever existed. But the bottom line was your son really is dying for a Winchester. Unless he has it, he won't be a real man. Over time, a gun culture was created based on nothing. Propaganda. Then along came the 2008 Supreme Court decision, which reversed a century of precedent, supposedly an originalist decision by the great scholar Scalia. You take a look at it, just read it. He had all sorts of learned references to the 17th century. Somebody said so and so. But missing in the decision is every single reason why the founders wanted guns and a militia. They had three reasons, basically. One was to kill Indians, because they were expanding over the West. They were invading what they called vacant lands, Indian country. It's one of the main reasons for the revolution. So you needed to kill Indians. Later, you needed militias to do it. You had to control the slaves. It was a slave society. Almost all the founders were slave owners. There were slave rebellions all over the Caribbean. They were very frightening. So you needed guns. The third was the British are coming. U.S. didn't have a standing army then. The British were frightening. In fact, they did come in 1812. So you needed the militias to fend them off. None of these have anything to do with the 20th century. Nothing. No. So the great originalist decision was a tremendous triumph. It said that the right to bear arms, individual right, not a militia right. You can kind of debate that arcane question, but it's, and that's what the legal profession focuses on. Side issue, you know, the main issue is why did the founders want people to have guns in the first place? Not for any reason has anything to do with the 20th century, let alone the 21st. So the whole thing is basically a con. Just about every piece of the propaganda system you look at falls apart as soon as you begin to analyze it. But is it done? No, it's not done, even by the best people. Like, take Emily Bazelon, a very good legal scholar and analyst, has a long article in the New York Times magazine about a week ago, criticizing the way the legal profession and so on is handling the Supreme Court and others. It's basically about the very successful Mitch McConnell effort to undermine the whole democratic system by stuffing the courts so that his policies will remain no matter who's in office. And she goes through this. She does discuss the Second Amendment. Good discussion of the debate in legal circles between the question, is it a, if you read the amendment, it's kind of ambiguous. Is it a militia right or an individual right? She says, points out correctly that the overwhelming evidence is for a militia right. That's the liberal view. It's beside the point. It's irrelevant. The whole Second Amendment has nothing to do with the 20th century, let alone now, when you look at the reasons why the founders wanted guns. But that's breaking out of the what's called common sense. You can't talk about that. People don't understand it. I mean, I've talked about this at law school, that people don't understand. It's very hard to break through deeply embedded, imposed consciousness. Common sense, as Gramsci called it. That's hard. And you can't expect Bernie Sanders or anyone to do that in a political campaign. You have to start where you are.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Just an interesting point. Do you think that problem is worse in the social media age when people are getting so much more information all the time that is propaganda more effective now that people are glued to their phones all day long and seeing messages, not just, you know, four times a day or reading the news in the morning and seeing it at night, but now it's 500 times a day that they're reading the news?
They're reading something. Whether it's the news or not, we could debate.
Right.
But I think we should recognize, as has been pointed out, Trump has been an absolute genius in propaganda. The best kind of propaganda, and he's a genius at it, is to just flood the airways with junk. Lies, fabrications, obvious fabrications, you know, like it's raining outside when it's sunny, doesn't matter what. Just flood everything with masses of lies and distortions. Then nobody knows what's going on. You're just overwhelmed. The idea, the very concept of truth and accuracy has kind of disappeared into the distance. At that point, you don't even need propaganda. Just let anything go on the social media. You're great. Then you go ahead and you do what you want. People who worship you will believe what you say. The people who, I wouldn't call it fascism or totalitarianism. It's kind of a new level of control of population. Control of population by immersing them in masses of information, disinformation, rants, screams, denunciations, and so on, so that there's nothing there but chaos. Now, it's not that hard to break through. As I said, it's not quantum physics. You stop to think for a little, you can find out what's going on. But it's very hard to do that alone. People do that sort of thing in groups. That's one reason why it's been so important during the neoliberal period to break up all associations, smash the unions, which were the main way that people could get together to have ideas, to interact, to discuss things, and so on, destroy every other association, leave people atomized alone. It's you and your iPhone. That's it. That's the social unit. You go to a McDonald's and watch a bunch of teenage kids having hamburgers, a superficial one among the people, kids sitting at the table, and each one's having his own conversation on the iPhone. You get a really atomized society. Everything's very superficial. There's no truth. There's no accuracy. People are alone. I can't fight the whole social media system. Okay, people are totally controlled. You have to break out of that. And that means breaking out at a very deep level. I mean, there are colleges now where on the sidewalks, pavements, they have plaques saying, look up. And if you walk around, you can see why. Kids are walking around with their glued to their iPhone. This is not any kind of life. Has to be dismantled at many levels. Now, that's the point, the place where you get, you need serious educational and organizational programs. Until those are done, it's going to be very easy to take somebody with mildly progressive programs, programs that wouldn't have surprised Dwight Eisenhower, and tour him as a communist who's going to turn everything into a gulag and take your toothbrush away. You know,
it seems like people, if we bring that up, that there is misinformation, disinformation that's much more nuanced from MSNBC and the New York Times. Often that's called Trumpian because Trump has so established himself as someone who talks about fake news. So now it's people pretend that any media critique is Trumpian, which of course shuts down media criticism. Sorry.
Actually, I feel somewhat guilty about this. Maybe I should have made it clearer, but I've done a lot of media critique in my life. And it's mostly directed against the liberal media because they're much more interesting.
Right.
They're the one, not just the media, right. It's the whole liberal intellectual establishment, academic, commentary and so on. They're much more interesting because they set the limits on discussion. Here I am, I'm as far as you can go, you can't go a millimeter farther. So that tells you a lot about the nature of the dominant doctrinal system. It's very easy to read Rush Limbaugh and say, sure, look, this is totally idiocy. It's no trick, which it is. And I suspect it's conscious. He can't believe the things he's saying. He must be, I'm sure he understands, this is a con. This is the way to get my tens of millions of listeners to keep tuned. I'll tell them one crazy thing after another. And nobody could believe what he's saying. So that's easy. But to go after the liberal media, the intelligent guys, the smart guys with degrees, that's more interesting. And it also has a negative effect that I didn't realize. It gets people to think you have to distrust the media. And that's not true. In fact, if you read the book that Herman and I wrote, Manufacturing Consent, about a third of the book is defense of the media. It's defense of the courage and integrity of reporters who are, however, acting, reporting within a framework that's distorting the nature of reality, but they're doing a serious professional job. And we were defending them against the attack by Freedom House. Freedom House, which is supposed to be the, the Tribune of the People, is launched a major denunciation of the media as being treacherous, losing the Vietnam War by their hatred of the U.S. government, all kind of grotesque nonsense, published two volumes, one of which was documentation, the other were ranting. The documentation was practically all false. So we went through all this. That's defense of the media, but critique in the sense that they're accepting the overall framework. So the journalists honestly and courageously described what was happening within the framework of we're losing our attempt to impose democracy on South Vietnam, not we're invading South Vietnam in the manner in which Nazi war criminals were hanged. Can't say that. You read the extreme left critique, Anthony Lewis, the most extreme left commentator in the media. The Vietnam War was started with the blundering efforts to do good. Blundering efforts, it failed. By the end, it was a disaster. We couldn't bring democracy to South Vietnam at an appropriate cost. I mean, this is left critique, internally accepting the whole propaganda framework, even when reporters are doing fine work and very courageous work. Okay, that's the way I think you have to understand the media. It's not that they're telling lies. No, they're working hard, telling the truth, good correspondents, honest people, most of them, but they're working within the same ideological framework that's imposed society. That's what they found in the liberal colleges and their liberal professors and so on and so forth. So you accept it. And that's, the first thing I do in the morning is read the New York Times. It's the best newspaper in the world. You want some general sense of what's going on, that's where you go. But you have to read it critically. You have to think, where's this coming? What is this, the presuppositions that they're making? Can we stop Iran's aggression by killing Soleimani? What's Iran's aggression? Where'd that come from?
Being surrounded by American bases.
Iran is the greatest threat to world. Right. Iran is the greatest threat to world peace. Iranian nuclear weapons are a terrible threat. We have to stop them. Okay, let's stop them. Is there a way to stop them? Yeah, very simple. Impose a nuclear weaponry zone in the Middle East. Not a problem. The Arab states have been strongly in favor of it for decades. Iran is strongly in favor of it. The out of 30 countries, strongly in favor of it. Europe isn't opposed. Why isn't it done? Okay, hard to find out. There's one country that blocks it. Which country? The United States. Every time the issue comes up at an international conference, the U.S. vetoes it. It includes Obama. The last time was Obama. Vetoed it at the non-proliferation review session. Why? Not hard to figure out. Israel has a huge nuclear capacity. You can't touch it. In fact, the United States won't even concede that it exists for a good reason. If we concede that it exists, then it turns out that U.S. aid to Israel is probably illegal under U.S. law, which bans aid to countries that construct nuclear weapons outside the framework of the Arms Control Agreement. So in order to protect Israel's nuclear weapon system, we're willing to face what's called the greatest danger in the world. I think people in the United States could understand that and appreciate it if it was brought to their attention. But where are you going to see it? Okay? Everywhere you look, you find these issues. I'm picking a few sort of at random, but you can go through the gamut and you find them everywhere. Now that means serious efforts to change consciousness and understanding. That's to start at the grassroots level and it can extend. None of these things are complicated, really. They're right on the surface. So much on the surface that it's almost boring to deal with them. I'm really sorry, but I have to break off much as I'd like to
continue. Okay.
Oh, that's okay. Right. Maybe we Professor, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And we understand that you've
you're busy.
It's an honor. Thanks so much.
That was great. I learned a lot today. I learned that he really knows everything from, like, you know, gun law, the Second Amendment. He just rattles all these names off. It's almost like Castroid.
Yeah.
Castrense, probably in Spanish. Castroino.
You know, I think his take on the press, you know, which obviously has been really important in my life, reading Manufacturing Consent. You know, I wrote a book that was essentially supposed to be a sequel to that book.
Hate Inc., which everyone should buy. It's great.
Yeah. And I sometimes wonder whether he's changed his thinking about some of those things, because, you know, he grew up in an era when, and he talked about this in the interview, how, you know, he actually does really believe in the press.
Right.
He always felt bad that Manufacturing Consent was seen as a thing that people pointed to when they decided they were going to hate people in the media. He, as he put it, you know, once to me, like, the New York Times is full of facts. Like, it's not, you know, this sort of disinformation silo. But I wonder if, you know, maybe that point of view needs to be updated a little bit. And so I sometimes think about that, because the performance of these stations and major news outlets has changed,
right,
you know, in the last 3 or 4 years, and they've changed their commercial strategies and everything. But he's still, you know, I think he's unique in his ability to kind of see through everything,
right,
and look at the bigger picture. And
he said he felt guilty because he felt like he hadn't been clear, but I felt guilty. I felt like maybe I wasn't clear enough. I obviously didn't mean like that he is responsible or anything, or that his view is Trumpian. I mean, he is such a good critique of the media and such good media criticism kind of criteria. And, you know, he wrote the book on it. I just meant more, what do we do about people constantly pretending that any criticism of the media is Trumpian?
Right.
And the other thing is, you know, it's like the New York Times does have more. I don't think it's that much of a contradiction. It's like the New York Times has more facts. The ratio of their facts to lies or facts to like insinuation is much higher than like Rush Limbaugh's. Right. But it still does have a lot of disinformation in it. It just has a lot of truth in it, but I guess it doesn't, we don't have to pretend that it's an either or. They can be, but it's,
absolutely. And there's the whole question of, you know, he talked about Trump being a genius in terms of his ability to manipulate the news networks and to keep himself in the news and to use those outlets as platforms of disinformation. But I wonder about whether that's more of a an arrangement between Trump and the, like, in other words, they're making so much money, whether they're willingly being manipulated.
Right.
So there's that whole question.
Was that guy at CBS who said it was good for ratings, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So less Moonves.
Yeah.
But no, very, very, very interesting. And he was one of the first people a long time ago to talk about how Sanders was being sort of miscast as this revolutionary firebrand.
Right.
His politics were a lot milder than were being represented in the press. That was really interesting to hear what he had to say about that.
I think that it's something you guys both seem to agree on, I think, right? Which is that it's not helpful for Sanders to call himself a democratic socialist. And I think that there's truth to that. But I think the flip side is that I think from the beginning, maybe he shouldn't have called himself that. The problem is Sanders' shtick is that he's so consistent and that he will not like bend to criticism or pressure. And he won't be like intimidated by polls or what's it called, focus groups. So I think that it would also be harming to him to change how he identifies. So I think, I see that he's screwed to some extent either way. I also think that that's not insurmountable. I mean, I think again, like all the media stuff that we constantly talk about is a bigger obstacle than his self-identification, because of course a responsible media could be like, look, people don't really care about these labels. They actually like what he says. Or look, when he says he's a democratic socialist, what that means is being a Democrat like FDR or Republican like, Eisenhower.
But that's a critique you hear of Sanders from across the spectrum. You hear it from people inside his campaign.
Yeah.
You hear it from other Democrat people in the Democratic Party. You hear it from Republicans that, just from a purely from a marketing point of view, that word was a big anchor for him.
Yeah.
And that, it proved to be pretty problematic.
Right.
But on the other hand, who knows? Maybe this campaign will have the effect of changing attitudes about the word.
Yeah.
So, but it, as he points out, he's swimming against 80 or 90 years of relentless propaganda.
Right. So and it would have had a marketing cost, I think, in that people would have said, Senator Sanders, you used to call yourself a democratic socialist. Why don't you call yourself that anymore? And that would have been another thing.
Right.
So
right.
Also a brand, marketing cost. But,
anyway, great talk, right?
Yeah, great very talk. Cool. Let's have him back.
Noam Chomsky. All right, excellent.
Bye, everyone.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.